Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. The idea of a culture war, or wars, has existed in America since the 1960s, an underlying ideological schism in our country that is responsible for the polarizing debates on everything from the separation of church and state, to abortion, to gay marriage, to affirmative action. Irene Tavis Thompson explores this notion by analyzing hundreds of articles addressing hot-button issues over two decades from four magazines, National Review, Time, The New Republic, and The Nation, as well as a wide array of other writings and statements from a substantial number of public intellectuals. Here to talk with us about her new book, Culture Wars and Enduring American Dilemmas, is Irene Tavis Thompson. Thompson is Professor Emeritus of Sociology, having taught in the Department of Social Sciences and History at Fairleigh Dickinson University for more than 30 years. Previously, she taught in the Department of Sociology at Harvard University. Welcome, Professor Thompson.
Thank you.
Most people probably envision this country as fairly divided, liberal and conservative, Democrat, Republican, and so on. What prompted you to come up with the idea of studying how these groups actually feel on hot-button issues?
I guess I need to go back in time for a little bit. Your question takes for granted the idea that we're divided into liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican. But in fact, if you were to ask most Americans in the fairly recent past what our divisions were about, they would most likely respond in terms of race or ethnicity or religion or even regional differences, but certainly not in terms of ideological or partisan ones. So, you know, the first question in a sense is, how did we get here? And I will resort to an answer that all too often is used, which is that back in the so-called 1960s, which of course really means the late 1960s, early 1970s, there were numbers of young people who began to seriously question traditional values and to rebel against them. They were quickly named the counterculture. So while the so-called mainstream culture in the United States respected authority, treasured religion, believed in the traditional family and sexual morality, here was the counterculture arguing that we should, quote, make love, not war, establishing communes, questioning all the practices that most Americans took for granted. But what happened then? Over time, many of the ideas that the counterculture advocated actually seeped into the mainstream. Others were abandoned. But what seriously remained was the very powerful idea that we had ongoing contests or struggles over how to define the culture. What is it we truly believed in? What was American culture about? What did we value? And after all, when you think about just the term counterculture, it suggests a real self-consciousness about culture that hadn't really been present earlier. The counterculture discussion wanes during the 70s, but comes back. It never really dies. And it comes back in the 1980s when the so-called New Right begins to discuss social issues and gets more involved in anti-abortion struggles and struggles about gay rights and so on. By the early 1990s, this now has a new name. It's named the Culture Wars. First, I think in 1991, the name appears in a book by a sociologist who was a sociologist of religion primarily, named James Davison Hunter. And Hunter's 1991 book, called The Culture Wars, really framed the discussion. Culture Wars was all about what Hunter saw as the division in the country between those people who believed that there were absolute moral truths, he called those people the Orthodox, and those who believed that morality was really a matter that rested in individual judgment. He called them the progressives. And as Hunter saw it, the Orthodox progressive split cut across all divisions in the society. Members of any race or social class or political party or even church might be split into Orthodox and progressive wings. That was 1991. It made a lot of noise. In 1992, the idea was really popularized when Patrick Buchanan, who was a very well-known conservative commentator and occasional candidate for the presidency, in fact, spoke to the Republican National Convention, and he talked about a cultural war taking place. He called it a struggle for the soul of America. And in his mind, clearly, the defining issues were abortion, homosexuality, what he called radical feminism, and school choice. After Buchanan's speech, the culture war idea became a staple of contemporary journalism, and Republicans and conservatives were seen as being on one side, Democrats and liberals on the other. I think it's really interesting to note that about 2 years after Buchanan's speech, James Hunter writes another book, and this one in 1994 is called Before the Shooting Begins. At the same time, social scientists looking at culture war issues don't find support for the idea. That is, when you look at a whole array of public opinion research, you don't find people consistently lined up as orthodox or progressive in their views. Only a very, very small number of Americans really have consistently progressive or orthodox views, even about the real hot-button issues like abortion or same-sex marriage. And even those who agree about one of those are not necessarily on the same side on issues of school prayer or censorship of family, of popular culture, and so on. So that doesn't really pan out. Most Americans are in the middle. They're moderate. They're centrist. And they're conflicted internally. You know, do I believe in the family? Of course. But do I believe in individual rights to go against family wishes? Of course I do if I'm an American. I believe in both. And so the culture war idea is challenged, in effect, by social scientists in their survey research data. But the supporters of the idea say, well, yes, 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 that may be so. Americans are indeed moderate. But if you examine the public culture, what's out there, what you find is elites on both sides arguing to persuade Americans to see things in their terms and really ruling out anything in the middle, forcing the discussion into opposing camps. Indeed, Hunter argues the very idea of morality has become a right-wing word. Progressives really just scoff at the idea of religion and spirituality. Well, if this is the case, then we really do have a culture war on our hands, and that's very serious because a society undergoing culture war will obviously lack the kinds of common standards and assumptions that allow us to have consensus on public policies. So it's a matter of some concern. Therefore, finally, I'm going to answer your question. I decided to test the idea that there is a culture war in the United States in the public culture by studying the writings of the partisans about culture war issues.
Okay, so how did you decide which issues to choose?
That actually was fairly simple. If you think about what those who argue about a culture war were talking about, Pat Buchanan, for example, talked about abortion, feminism, homosexuality. Those and so-called family values were on everybody's list. The 1992 presidential campaign had a huge debate about so-called family values when Dan Quayle talked about Murphy Brown, a TV character, having a baby out of wedlock and so on. Those were obvious. Equally obvious were matters pertaining to education, popular culture, and the arts, because there were lots of areas of contention. Pat Buchanan, in his Republican National Convention address, added the term school choice. What that represented was the idea that parents should be able to send their children to schools whose values match their own. They should have some ability to have control over the curriculum. So conflicts that had arisen about school curricula, multicultural education, sex education, were also part of the culture wars. And this extended to controversies at the college and university level as well about what should be taught. So all of those were part of the culture wars, as were any issues pertaining to religion, school prayer, teaching creationism, where the lines between church and state should be drawn. All of those were clearly, in anybody's mind, part of the culture wars. So those were the issues that feature in the book.
Okay, so let's talk about how you went about this. What method did you choose to study their attitudes, and why?
If you go back to 1991 and the publication of Hunter's book on culture wars and look at what he used to argue that partisans on both sides were really engaging in this kind of war, you will find that his materials, the materials he analyzed, were promotional materials. That is, advertisements, sound bites on the news, direct mail letters, op-ed pieces, and such material is always, by its very nature, exaggerated. It's superficial. It's exaggerated. It has to be attention-grabbing because it's trying to get you to give your time and your money to the cause. And so, obviously, I thought, well, this is not the only way to look at what's in the public culture. There must be a broader, deeper literature. And clearly one of the easiest ways of finding this is to look at what's in the political magazines, the magazines that are fairly popular, that are mainstream, nothing extreme, but what the public culture is showing will appear in Time and in The Nation and The New Republic and National Review. Those were the four magazines that I chose. They were chosen clearly to represent the spectrum. So there's National Review on the right, The Nation on the left, Time clearly in the center, and The New Republic in a rather ambiguous position. It was a very clearly liberal magazine, but it moved to the right during the 1980s. So it has elements of both sides. Okay, I looked at all the articles pertaining to culture war issues that were published in those four magazines between 1980 and 2000. There were actually a total of 436 articles, quite a lot. Though the culture wars weren't named until the 1990s, there was a great deal of discussion of them in the 1980s. The 1980s saw really virulent anti-abortion protests. It saw Anita Bryant, a name probably younger people don't know anymore, who went across the country campaigning against laws that promoted equality for homosexuals. It saw President Reagan proposing a constitutional amendment to allow for school prayer. In 1984, this was. And the response from the left to this was, he's initiating a cultural war. Here was all this outpouring of discussion of culture war issues from 1980 to 2000. I analyzed this material by looking at what did they say, what were their underlying assumptions, and how did the culture warriors on both sides justify their positions.
So what did you find out?
Well, the main finding, really, is that the culture warriors on both sides adhere to very similar American cultural ideas. Far, very far from morality being a matter of something that the right endorses, all sides cast their arguments in moral language. So the right defends the family. It defends tradition. It attacks the popular culture for its various evils. And this is a matter, as they see it, of defending morality. But the left sees it as a matter of defending morality when they rail against inequality, inequalities of men and women, inequalities of gays and straights. So if the right attacks the immorality of television talk shows, the left attacks the immorality of having these poor, underprivileged, needy people exploited as guests. And so it goes all the way through. Religion. American culture supports respect for religion, even if we're not clear exactly what its role should be, and there are certainly arguments about where the lines should be drawn. Nevertheless, left and right converge in supporting the idea that there's nothing wrong with religious discourse in the public sphere. So Bill Buckley on the right will talk about why can't Americans say that we are against greed and we're against adultery because they're wrong, as the Bible tells us. On the left, Harvey Cox, a very well-known liberal theologian from Harvard, says, listen, we have to support religion. Religious institutions give us a space that's removed from the commercial society, from the day-to-day societies. It gives us a place to resist the dominant culture, to resist the commercial society that overwhelms us. Both sides agree. Both sides respect religious institutions. All agree that pluralism within one culture is what America is about. There is almost no support for the idea that we are a fundamentally multicultural society. What we need is one culture, but lots of room for differences within. So left and right both see pluralism as a kind of answer to the culture wars. Remember, I mentioned that Pat Buchanan talked about school choice. The idea here is really an endorsement of pluralism. It says, let parents control the local education levels. Let them have control over the culture-making arenas for their children. Let this be decentralized. Let it be pluralistic. The concern on the right is often largely rural groups, small town groups, religious groups who may feel excluded from the larger mainstream. On the left, though, pluralism is very valued as well. And what the left says, let's allow for pluralist institutions. Let's have gay men's health centers and female-operated banks and Black Baptist nursery schools. Why not? Pluralism, but within one overarching American culture. Everybody agrees on that. Everybody endorses individualism, right? But the culture war stereotypes that picture the left as saying individual freedoms are what count, and indeed individual licentiousness, let individuals do whatever they want, while the right supports the common good and larger purposes, this isn't true. Both sides support individualism, but only up to a point. If it's excessive, it's seen as selfish. Both left and right support individual freedoms, individual rights, but not to excess. Both left and right support the need to rein in individualism for the sake of the larger community. Both sides show ambivalence about elites. On the one hand, we praise and respect achievement and high standards. On the other hand, we want to be populist. We want to support the people against the elites. Both sides do this. So everybody draws on the same basic American culture. And indeed, the very language that they use is often so similar, you can't tell who's talking unless you know who's written the article. Culture warriors use the same symbols. Let me give you a simple example here. I will read a quote. A culture that is at once moralistic, self-righteous, alienated, and in a minority will constantly be tempted to break the rules of political discourse. End of quote. Well, if I just read that quote, that line, without knowing the author, I would have guessed that it was a progressive writing complaining about the role of Christian fundamentalists in American politics. But boy, would I be wrong. This was actually written by a very well-known conservative, Robert Bork, who was complaining about the left in American politics. And I think this is just yet another illustration of how the commonalities in American culture appear in the thinking of both sides. American culture is one that respects morality, but also is pragmatic. And as a result, we're all supposed to be moral. But, you know, I'm moral and you, my opponent, you're moralistic. This is part of American culture. It's silly in a way, but it's because of our interest in morality and pragmatism. We're encouraged to be individualistic, but not to the point of being disengaged from the community. So being alienated is not good. Aside from the commonalities, the sharing in American cultural symbols and ideals, the other major finding is that the arguments of the culture warriors, like the feelings revealed in surveys about the American population, are ambivalent, are conflicted, are not internally clear and in one direction. There's a great deal of internal disagreement. So you get people who avidly support the rights of women to have abortions, who nevertheless see abortion as painfully immoral. You have people who are hostile to gay rights, who are nevertheless questioning whether or not it's a matter of morality at all. You have homosexual rights advocates who are on both sides of the same-sex marriage issue. Is it a plus or a minus? Is it ultimately a radical idea or a conservative idea to allow same-sex marriage? You have conservatives and liberals unable to agree among themselves about whether popular culture should be censored. You even have, let me give you a simple example, conservatives arguing in some ways on the same side, but yet not completely in agreement on issues of what do we do about supporting the arts. There was a lot of controversy about art that was seen as immoral or ugly at the time. And Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich and Senator Henry Hyde, both very well-known conservatives, both said the public should not pay for art that is offensive to them. So they both criticized the National Endowments for the Arts. But Gingrich said there was a simple solution, just remove all funding for the arts from the federal budget. Henry Hyde said, oh, that would be dreadful. That would show that we as a society can't come up with solutions. So even on something that simple and that limited, internal disagreements are very plentiful.
What most surprised you about your conclusions?
I think several things were surprising. One was the degree to which the spokespersons on both sides really subscribe to the same overarching American culture. You know, as a social scientist and just as an American in this time, I'm so painfully aware of all of our differences. You know, subcultures based on race and class and gender and religion, market niches, partisan divisions, ideological divisions, that sometimes I think we fail to recognize that these play out within a distinctively American context. Again, I think a simple example. Here's a writer who is arguing that the traditional family is really in tune with what she calls the facts of human nature. So she says, we should teach children about family values, and then immediately feels a need to say, this does not inhibit their self-expression. Children who are trained in family values are free to reject those values when they mature. So giving them instruction in family values is not oppressive. This is an amazing thing that she needs to see. She needs to defend against the idea that she's destroying self-expression by training the children in family values. But she's displaying this characteristic American cultural peculiarity that we respect individualism and traditional authority at the same time. And this appears over and over again in survey data, and it appears clearly as well in this elite public culture discussion of the culture wars. So I think the degree to which the American dilemmas and cultural dilemmas and contradictions shine through was impressive. Another thing that surprised me was that the idea of multiculturalism, which was so much talked about, was in fact rejected by the overwhelming majority of writers. They saw on both sides, of course, they saw multiculturalism as a denial of our individuality. America's a society of individuals, they said, not groups. And individuals can overcome their culture. Even those on the left who are very sympathetic to racial and ethnic minority groups were seeking greater political and economic power for them, not greater cultural expression. And I think I was also surprised by the sheer intensity and scope of the internal debates. You know, when you read someone on the left calling other liberals fascists because they approve of character education in the schools, you really get a sense of how much passion there is in these debates. On the right, there were arguments about the very nature of what the country is. Is this a nation of immigrants, or is this a nation like any other nation in which one ethnic group will eventually emerge? Are homosexual acts kept private, not discussed in public, less threatening to the morality of the nation, as some conservatives suggested? Or, as other conservatives argued, does the very idea of morality require that issues be part of the common culture, endorsed by policies discussed in the open? So, in very, very strong issues, fundamental issues, are a matter of debate on both sides.
What implications do you feel this has for elected officials and others charged with representing our views?
Well, I think, you know, if you step back for a moment and think about politicians and political figures, the appeal of culture wars is obvious. You know, if I can suggest to you that my opponent is a threat to your very values and your way of life, what better way do I have of potentially mobilizing you to come out and vote and support me? What my research shows is there isn't really a culture war in this sense of deep division, real structured cultural divisions that lead to totally irreconcilable positions. We have tended to make the assumption that if there is a cultural difference at issue, somehow it can't be bridged. There's no compromise possible. But this is false. You know, even on the really most difficult issues like abortion, a majority of Americans probably do not come down on it's always right or it's always wrong. They really are in the it depends camp. And the elites who want to influence us are in many ways also sensitive to context and are not absolutes. So the culture war as such doesn't exist. And there's been a lot of research that suggests that it really doesn't even help the political candidates. One could argue that if you go back and look at the elections, 2000, 2004, 2008, culture wars arguments did not bring in the votes. I mean, just very obviously, in 2000, everybody was on the same side. Bush, Gore, and Gore's vice presidential nominee, Joseph Lieberman, all said the same thing. They all advocated cleaning up popular culture to restore morality and to reinforce family values. They all spoke of the importance of faith in their own lives. They all advocated the need for the government to support faith-based programs. There was no culture war in that election. They were all in the same place. In the 2004 election, real careful analysis shows that Bush did not, in fact, benefit from the votes of people who were concerned about culture war issues. In 2008, of course, the culture war was very much muted because the economy trumped the culture. But Barack Obama actually came to national attention in 2004 with his address to the Democratic National Convention. And at that point, he very self-consciously spoke of, in a sense, overcoming the culture war. He spoke approvingly of religiosity in the blue states and concern for civil liberties in the red states. Okay, when you think about the so-called hot-button issues, many of them are already much less contentious than they had been. There's a lot of data suggesting that attitudes about gays in the military, for example, much more converging today than they were in the early 90s when the issue first came up. Similarly, what exactly is our division about feminism and family values like when, in 2008, the conservative candidate for vice president was a mother of five, one of whom was an unmarried pregnant teenager? Clearly, it's hard to see cultural wars in the way in which many of the advocates had argued. It's also clear that the complexities of viewpoints are greater than I think the simplifiers would have us believe. Let me give you an example, again, taken from the abortion issue, which is certainly one of the most contentious. The idea of the culture war, after all, is that elites on both sides try to frame how we think about an issue. Okay. So obviously, those who are opposed to abortion have called themselves, as we all know, pro-life. And they're seeking to connect abortion to our very clear weddedness to the idea of the sanctity of human life. On the other side, the advocates of abortion rights call themselves pro-choice. And they are, of course, trying to link abortion to the rights of women, to gender equality, to privacy rights, sometimes to the separation of church and state. Well, if you look at the public opinion data, which we have a great deal of now from the late 70s onward, what this data show is that the pro-life framing of the issue has gained support. The pro-choice framing of the issue has not. The sanctity of human life seems more tied to abortion than gender rights and privacy rights are. And yet, the framing does not influence how people feel about the policy issues. So we have more people wedded to the pro-life view of what abortion is about, but we don't have more people opposed to abortion. Again, in the American cultural sense, this is the morality versus pragmatism dilemma. And so, pragmatism apparently is winning in this particular issue, at least temporarily. So I think the ultimate conclusion is that what public figures, politicians, and others must recognize is that the American cultural dilemmas, morality versus pragmatism, individualism versus the community, populism versus elitism, dilemmas about pluralism and about the role of religion, all of these are issues that are basically part of American culture in perpetuity. They're never going to be resolved. They're always going to be brought up anew as times change, situations change. And what the political figure who truly represents Americans will seek to do is actually to combine both sides, to respect both morality and pragmatism, both individualism and the community and so on. And they will understand that there is really a unity in American culture that encompasses all the various subcultures within it. So the communal cultures of Latin American or Asian subcultures are just as much a part of American culture as the individualism of the lonely American who separates himself from the group and goes off on his own.
So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on the Tea Party movement and their place in the culture wars. Do you want to speak to that at all?
It's very interesting that the Tea Party movement has almost self-consciously avoided culture war issues. The Tea Party movement is distinctly setting itself up on the issue of the size and scope of the government and taxes, deficits, things like health care reform are really what it's all about. And if you read some of the spokespersons from the movement, they will actually say that they don't want to go near gay rights or abortion or those things because they might they might have the effect of fragmenting their own movement. So they don't want to do it. They are purely focused on an older view of a conservative in the sense of economic and political conservatism, which means dramatically reduced role for the size and scope of the government, lowering taxes, lowering government welfare programs in the largest sense. And then, interestingly, amusingly, there is now a coffee party, which is nowhere near as big as the Tea Party, which is on the other side. So the coffee party is out there supporting old-fashioned, liberal, progressive government involvement in the economy.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Thompson. This has been very illuminating.
You're welcome.
We have been speaking with Irene Tavis Thompson, author of Culture Wars and Enduring American Dilemmas. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.